Good morning.
Good morning.
My name is Mary and I am an alcoholic.
I'm Mary.
And I'm so grateful to be here and grateful to be sober. My dry date is the 10th of August, 1984. So by God's great grace. And my group is the Markham Village Group in Markham, Ontario. We have an open meeting on a Monday night, and on a Thursday night we have a closed meeting. I have a sponsor. I sponsor women. I'm an active member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I think that is one of the greatest things I can say about my life, is that I am a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. Because without that, I would have nothing. And without Alcoholics Anonymous, I would not have the consciousness of the presence of God that keeps me sane and keeps me sober on a daily basis since the 10th of August 1984. It's all God, and I thank God for the great grace that He's given all of us. I would like to thank Polly so much. Polly, I just love you. Love you so much. I was together with Polly and Pat last weekend in LA, and I mean, to get to see them this often is just a blessing. And I'd like to thank Lee and all the Anne and John and the people who help him, because they are an archive of the history that we try and make here every time we have one of these. And it's thank you, Lee. You know, Lee was praying with me, and he said, he was asking God to help me. He said, God, Mary's been doing this for a long time. And because I am irreverent sometimes, and I'm thinking, for the same amount of time I've been lusting after Lee. I was coming down on the elevator this morning, and there was one poor little man. He must have been on about the 17th floor. And the women just keep coming in everywhere. And he's trying to disappear slowly into the corner. And then when we are fully loaded, and I look at him, and he doesn't know what to do. I mean, it's a 15-year-old's dream, but not a 70-year-old's dream. And he's kind of disappearing into. I said, "You're feeling a bit overwhelmed, aren't you?" He said, "I am." It's cool. And I thought, can you imagine if we were all drinking? Wouldn't that make the news? He survived an elevator ride with 20 alcoholics. Came on fully dressed. Amanda, thank you. You're just great up here. I just love having you up here. Thank you so much. And I've been watching your mother. I've been watching your mother's face, because she never knows what you're going to say, right, Georgia? I would also like to thank Cynthia, Reagan and Jenny, who took me shopping yesterday. Thanks, girls. We had such a blast, and we had lunch afterwards, and we spoke about this program. You know, it's what an amazing thing it is that we've been given. You know, I guess you figured out by now that you're here because you're not all there. If you have any doubt, check out with me. I will let you know. You know, the first step, there's a suggestion in the first step, and it is perhaps that we are powerless. There is a great suggestion in the second step. You know what it is? If you have to come to believe that a power greater than yourself can restore you to sanity, then it must mean what? Can it be that I'm not sane? All I did was not drink too much. Not quite. And in the fourth step, there is another suggestion. That I have to make a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. What does that mean, moral? Does that mean perhaps that I am immoral? I know that you were worse than I was. Anytime you hear that dirty laugh, you just... I just want to make sure I thank. I also want to thank Sandy for being a great host. And I've got my sponsee Peggy here, and Cheryl was supposed to come in. And it's great, Peggy. It's so great to see you, darling. I love you so much. And you know all the other speakers that are here too, and Michael and Beth and everybody, Ellen. And I mean, Katie and you know, I just love you, Katie. And you did such a great job, and Pat did such a great job. So here we go. Socrates, the Greek philosopher, said a long, long time ago that the unexamined life is not worth living. The unexamined life is not worth living. I was kind of brought up on that stuff. I was born in Glasgow, Scotland in 1943 during the Second World War. I used to blame that and my problems. I used to imagine that I came out of my mother's womb as they were dropping a bomb on the Clyde. And I thought, this isn't a good reception, I'm going back. And I've been trying to get back ever since. Because there was just no ease and comfort for me in the world. Never. I don't remember ever feeling ease and comfort from when I could consciously think. That if there is a predisposition to the illness of alcoholism, I will tell you I've got it. And I will tell you how it manifested in me. It manifested in me in feelings of difference, in feelings of not being enough, in feelings of being less than, in feelings of having this unbearable, unsheddable burden of self-consciousness. A self-consciousness that was pathological. A self-consciousness that had absolutely nothing to do with self. A self-consciousness that hated self, that was forever examining self. I thought everywhere I went, you were all looking at me and finding me wanting. Finding me not enough. And because I had those feelings, what happens is they transmitted into something. And they transmitted into having an edge in life. And the way I had an edge in life from about 5-6 years old was by lying and cheating and stealing. I began to develop an edge. And then because I'm a Catholic and I wasn't supposed to be doing these things, I began to have panic attacks. And also I began to have panic attacks. And then I had an obsession with death. All before I was 13. So you could never say that I qualified for the definition of sanity, which is soundness of mind. I did not have it. Okay. The obsession with death was a nightmare for me. And that's what used to bring on the panic. And then I became aggressive. And the most beautiful gift to me was that when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous and I read Bill's story, well, and there's a wonderful book called The Language of the Heart. He's written an essay in there, which I love. And in that essay, he writes about the neuroses of the alcoholic before he drinks. And Bill's definition of that neurosis and condition was exactly what I figured. It was exactly what I had. You know, I was so obsessed with death. I remember my first date. This guy took me out. And he's getting very hot and passionate with me at the end of the night. That's what men in Scotland do. They take you out and they want a reward. And I'm watching him being passionate from a distant place. Just kind of looking at him because I'm thinking about myself. I'm not involved in what he's doing. And at the height of his passion, I said to him, "So what do you think about death?" He said, "I think you should go home now." I said it last week in my talk, last week I said it in my talk, my favorite tune when I was drinking. You know, there's a song that you play over and over and over again. Mine was Masquerade by George Benson. Searching but not finding, understanding anywhere, I'm lost in a masquerade. Not only was I lost in a masquerade, I developed what in Jungian terms is called a mask. I developed a mask that wouldn't let me know who I really was. And in the end, I lost who I really was. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, I had been living on the street. I'd been living on the street in Miami. And let me just tell you, I started drinking at 25, fast forward. Started drinking at 25, I believe I became an immediate alcoholic. Started drinking at 25 in Kingston, Jamaica. I had everything that money could buy. I had two beautiful children. Fast forward to, that was 1980. Fast forward to 1980. I was born in 43, so 1980. And I'm living on the street. I've lost my children. Both my parents are dead. Their last memories of me are calling them drunk for help. Mother died of ovarian cancer. Father died of a massive heart attack, worrying about me. So parents dead, children gone, house gone, humanity gone, femininity gone, nothing left. Nothing left but an insatiable desire for alcohol. That's all that was left in me. Oblivion, and I hardly ever got it. I get madness. You cannot stay drunk 24 hours a day. I've tried it. I have tried it. There is nothing I have not tried with alcohol. There is no place that alcohol hasn't taken me, except the grave. And that would have been kinder than the life I lived on the street. My life on the street was like going through a sewer in a glass bottom boat. We laugh a lot in here. This is the worst illness in the world. And they have as little understanding of it today as they ever did. Ever. They expect you and me to be normal people. We are not. Listen. If my problem was just drinking, then for the first year I got sober, every day I went to 3 meetings a day. And if the problem was just drinking, the old timer would say to me, "Good morning, Mary, did you drink last night?" "No, see you at lunchtime." "Hi, Mary, had a good lunch, yep." "Did you drink?" "No, see you tonight." "Hi, Mary, you going to have a good night?" "Yep." "Okay, did you drink?" "No, see you in the morning." At the end of a year, it would say she didn't drink, but her head blew apart. Because the problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, not the body. The mind, not the body. And what is the mind? The mind is not the brain. Dolly, we've spoken about that. The mind is not the brain. You know. It's not. You can't put it under a microscope. In the olden days, they called the mind the soul. And in the early days of AA, they called alcoholism a soul sickness. And that's what I had. I had a soul sickness. Carl Jung, in his letter to Bill Wilson, said that the unfulfilled spiritual need will eventually be led into evil by the drinking that we do. And that's what I was. Drinking evil sins. So when I made this searching and fearless moral inventory of myself, I had been in AA about 3 or 4 months. When I got off the street, I had ended up 4 years in and out the mental institutions. Now, I love being in the mental institutions. Who in here has been in a mental institution?
Gotcha. See, I did that so quick, you didn't have time to think. Right. And you know, being in the mental institution, I loved it. Because I got oblivion compliments of the government 24 hours a day. I loved all the yum yums, the litty yum, the libri yum, the bali yum, the yum yum. But I was in agony. Agony. There has been nothing worse for me in my life than to have to leave my children in Jamaica, get thrown out of Jamaica, and wander the world, just me and liquor. Just me and liquor, wandering the world, drunk, falling down drunk, screaming in my heart, screaming in my soul, what happened? Where are my children? Why can I not stop drinking? How could this little liquid kill me like this? Take away my sons. I want to die. I can't die. I've tried to die. I can't die. Can anybody help me? So then they start giving me psychiatric medication. And it helps me for a little bit. And then it doesn't. Because then I have to drink again. Nothing works. Nothing in the world works. Let me die. But I want to see my children again. So I don't really want to die. Will I ever see my children? No. These are the things that were going on. It is a madness beyond explanation. I don't have the words for it. I don't have the words for the terror, bewilderment, frustration and despair that this illness of alcoholism causes to people like you and me. And it is an amazing thing to me that prior to 1935, chronic alcoholics like me were doomed to die. So when I was in a mental institution, they used to bring in AA meetings. I never heard anything because I was so full of drugs. And the AA members told me later, they used to say to me, "Mary, do you have hope?" And I said to them, "I have no hope." I was in a perfect condition to receive this program. I was utterly and completely hopeless. Does anybody in here know what it is to be utterly and completely hopeless? Utterly and do you know that we are the most fortunate people in the world? Because when you are utterly and completely hopeless, and the medical society has written you off as utterly... See, it's just like I say, you know, I always knew there was something seriously wrong with me. Because people were always saying to me, "There's something seriously wrong." So I always knew I was utterly and completely hopeless, because the police who knew used to say, "I think you're completely hopeless." Because they had arrested me so many times. You know, making a searching and fearless moral inventory was nothing new to me. I was always having it done to me. The cops were always making a searching and fearless. One comb, one bottle. I was always having my inventory taken. So one night I called AA and a man called Stan came. He 12-stepped me and he told me I was one of them, and I got into AA and I loved it. But here's the thing, and I'm not taking anybody's inventory, I'm just saying we have to be careful, because if there is anything killing people in Alcoholics Anonymous today, it's the heavy drinkers we have in here. The heavy drinkers that say you don't have to do the steps. Watch out. So I had the man and woman sponsor me, my first sponsors, and you know, they're one of those, it used to be in the old days, it used to be the couples in AA. So you ask the wife, but you also get the husband, right? And
They were very good to me, make no mistake. I'm not going to mention it, but I came off psychiatric medication at my own request, and I had AA members stay with me for 3 weeks, 24/7 shifts. That's the dedication I got from you. So then they told me that I should wait a year until I did the steps, step 4 and 5. Consequently, I wasn't accepting my life and I wanted my sons. I was in Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, and they were in Jamaica. And I did a stupid thing that I shouldn't have done, and it just caused more grief. And I drank again. And a little girl spent the night with me and said the third step prayer, and I won't go into that, that's third step stuff, but something very profound happened. I had that shift. You know, just very quickly, because, you know, we had Billy, and we were saying how much Mary loves Jung. Well, I do, I love Carl Jung. It's an amazing thing. In 1906, Carl Jung came to the United States of America, and he was attending a conference at a college, and Clark's College, and he met a William James. And William James had just come from Edinburgh University, where he had written where he had given lectures on the varieties of religious experience. And he conferred with Jung, and in the conference with Jung, he told Jung that what happens, he said, sometimes I've been observing these people who have huge emotional displacements. You know, they seem to be hopeless and incurable, and yet something happens once in a while, and they have these strange emotional shifts that changes their whole way of being. And Jung had that in his mind when he treated Roland Hazard, who was a hopeless alcoholic. And that was eventually transmitted to us. Isn't that amazing how that came about? So what happened was, when this little girl said the third step prayer with me, then something shifted. And I didn't want to drink anymore from that night, 10th of August 1984. I don't know what happened, but I didn't want to drink anymore. And then I was going to a lot of meetings, and I was coming off all these meds that I had been on. I had no meds since the 10th of August 1984, my dry date. And then in 4 weeks, I got shingles. It was kind of shocking to my system too. And I'm lying in bed, and I start reading the big book. Now, in 1984, there was no big book studies in my area, right? Nobody was taking you through the book. There was an old woman called Helen, and she said something, she quoted something from the big book. And I said to her, "Where is that in the big book, Helen?" She used an expletive, and I won't use it from here. But she said, "Read the whole adjective book." What a terrible bunch you are. Read the whole book until you come to it. So I did. I read the whole book. I read the whole book. And I read there that without a fearless and moral inventory, the faith that will be required for me will not happen. That without a fearless and moral inventory, I am going to drink again. And that made absolute sense to me, because that was why I had just had that slip, when I thought I would never drink again. You see, here's what happened to me. I hated myself when I came in here. I hated myself. There wasn't one thing about me that I liked. And I did not know how I could live consciously with all the things I had done. With all my sins, I called them sins, I had not been a good human being. And I didn't know how I could live with that on a daily basis without doing this fearless moral inventory. So then I thought, how am I going to do this? And then, when I was reading through the book, and I was reading Bill's story, he said, "I ruthlessly faced my sins and became willing to have my newfound friend take them away."
his newfound friend, God, take them away. Root and branch, he didn't have a drink since. Okay, so that's what I did. And then he said that people really never got well until they told somebody all of their life story. I'm just telling you how I did it in the beginning. Because I could not do the columns. The columns meant nothing to me when I came in and read that book, because I'll tell you why. I didn't have one resentment the minute I sat down with that. No, I happened to discover some later. But I had that incredible desire. And also, when I had done the third step with this little girl, I had had a mea culpa. I think it was God's gift of grace to me. A mea culpa. My fault. It's my fault. I saw the vision that everything bad that had happened to me was my fault. Then I must disregard the other person completely. Totally disregard. So I was doing a fourth column in my first step, the first time I ever did it, without doing the other three. So I got out a piece of yellow foolscap. I had no direction except what I prayed for. I had fired that sponsor and sponsored. Well, actually, I called her up when I had my slip. Took her inventory. And told her I had more sobriety at that moment in my little finger We just recently became friends again. So page 73 in the big book. Let's see. They took inventory, all right, but hung on to some of the worst items in stock. They only thought they had lost their egoism and fear. They only thought they had humbled themselves. But they had not learned enough of humility, fearlessness, and honesty. In the sense we find it necessary until they tell someone all of their life story. And I still do that with some of my young sponsees today that are too adult to sit down and do the columns. I say, we'll do them later. Right now I want you to do all of your life story. So I wrote out all of my life story. Because up until age 25, when I took my first drink, I had led a life that my mother did not approve of. I had been a user and a taker long before I ever drank. User of people. And I had created a false persona for myself. I had lied. I got into a marriage when the person didn't even know who they were marrying. You know, I always tell him, I married a nice man and he married a figment of my imagination. So I wrote everything out from when I could remember. I just wrote and wrote and wrote and wrote on this foolscap paper. Now here's the other thing I did. The one piece of advice I got from the members at the time was if you insist on doing this fourth step, this stuff, you got to phone somebody and make an appointment to do your fifth step before you start it. So I did. And at that time, I still didn't trust anybody in AA very much because I didn't know you well enough. And you all looked so good to me and I thought you would be disgusted by my story. I thought, you've never been where I've been and seen what I've seen. So I decided to put all this stuff back where I thought it belonged. There was a Roman Catholic priest, and he was a recovering member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he was a Jesuit, and he had four steps. So I called him and I made an appointment.
And I thought I'd be through the shingles by the time I finished this thing, and if not, I was still going. And so I just wrote it all out. And you know, I read over and over, and I said, nothing mattered but thoroughness and honesty. Thoroughness and honesty. How honest can I be? How much do I really know myself? Well, this is what I do know. I know how much I hated myself. I know how much... Do you see all the things that were right up here? You know when you stop drinking, and the next day you're thinking about your life? And it becomes, and you go, oh, how could I have done that? You know? And sometimes you're walking on the street again and you think, oh my God, how could I have done that? And then when your parents are dead, you think, oh my God, how can I ever fix this? And then when your children are gone, you go, oh my God, how can I ever be a mother to my little 9-year-old? He's not 9 anymore. You know, it just seems insurmountable. You know? Oh my God, that guy I knocked off his bike in Jamaica and landed up in the river, did he die? These are not little things. These are massive things. These are the things that you think you'll never tell anybody. I found out later about that, by the way. I did find out later about that. I managed to fix it all up. My promiscuity from an early age. Wow. My mother was president of the Union of Catholic Mothers. I have two aunts in Scotland. One of them just died recently, 87, virgins. Don't even think about it. Well, yes, if you want to know, I got my cherry back at 15. Yeah. Spiritual remake. Stealing, lying, selfishness, inconsideration of others, the trouble I had caused since I was young, the trouble in my family, the discord in my family, the tears, the sadnesses, the broken promises and broken dreams, running away from home at 15, pushing my mother down the stairs at 15, stealing from my mother's purse. My stealing started like Eve in the Garden of Eden with an apple. Just after the war, we still had a lot of rationing, and in my school, the Americans sent us big... Oh, I'm in America. I keep forgetting about that. You've all got such funny accents. And the American troops had sent us big crates of apples to all the school. So all of the schools, because we'd never had apples. And of course, one apple was not enough for me. So I asked to go to the washroom, because some of the kids had put their apples in their pocket for later. I ate mine immediately. As I'd done with everything, men, everything, you know. You know, with men it's a, hi, how are you? I love you, let's get married. What's your name? And him and I get married and we're like Velcro. And then after 3 weeks I can hear him breathing three doors down. Did he always breathe like that? Oh, you? So, inconsistency, inconsiderate. And I really looked at that. I thought, why was I, well, the priest asked me, and I mean, why was I so promiscuous? Why? I had not been taught anything like that. Why was I so promiscuous? It wasn't because of sex. I was too involved in myself to be involved in sex. I would do the act, but I wouldn't be present. I mean, my body would be present, but I'd be thinking about myself. I know everything there is to know about sex. I know nothing about intimacy. I've been married 4 times. I know nothing about intimacy. Because I'm so absorbed in myself. It's almost like he's performing this act all by himself. And I'm just the detached onlooker. I'm thinking about how somebody looked at me the other day. My backstreet abortion at age 16. Roman Catholic. I won't even go into that backstreet abortion. I almost died. It's a nightmare. The creation of the false self, the infidelity, the suffering, the inflicted tragedy of my life. A judge called me once a tragic social circumstance. Oh, well, you have no compassion back there. Do you know what a tragedy is? We're tragedies that have created this all by ourselves. That's what a tragedy is. An unbearable situation created by yourself. The immorality of my life, and how am I going to talk? So I spoke to the priest, and he said to me, okay. And he said, why do you think that from a very early age you had this sex? From your early age. I said, I think maybe it was just that I wanted someone to love me. It wasn't so much the sexual act. I think I just wanted someone to hold me. Because in Scotland, they're very stoic. You know, you don't hug. You don't kiss. You just give somebody a cake and a sweetie, a candy. That's why we... Every year I go to Scotland, one of the first questions my family used to ask is, are those all your own teeth? Teeth are a rare commodity in Scotland. The other question is that AA found out what's wrong with you yet? He said, I'm going to give you something else to think about. He said, perhaps you felt so insignificant. Perhaps you felt so lacking in self-esteem that you had sex for power, to have someone to succumb to you. I never thought about that before. That I use sex as power to make someone succumb to me. And you know, we do, I found out later in reading more, that we do use sex as a weapon. We use sex to either hit somebody with it or to withhold it from someone. When I went down to that priest with my list, and he said a prayer with me, and then he asked me to read out my life story. And we said a lovely prayer before. And the prayer that we said before was the St. Francis of Assisi prayer that we call the 11-step prayer. And I sat down in downtown Edmonton, Alberta, and I read out this list that was the most honest thing I had ever done. I was 40 years old. 40 years old and 6 weeks sober. And I had been drinking for 15 years. But I had 40 years, or at least 35 years, to put on that list that I could remember. And every now and then, when I thought I would shock him with some of the things I cannot talk about from the podium, he looked at me with such compassion and sorrow. And he said to me when I'd finished, "I'm going to leave you for a minute and I'll come back and see if there's anything else that you want to tell me." And when he left and came back, I said, "There's one more thing," because I did not want to leave that office with one more conscious thing. There might have been a lot in the unconscious that God hadn't allowed to suffer yet, but in my conscious mind. And I told him, and he said to me, "I am so sorry your poor soul has been in this despair." And he told me about St. John of the Cross and the dark night of the soul. And we spoke about your poet, your writer, Scott Fitzgerald, who died of alcohol-related problems. He wrote that in the real dark night of the soul, it's always 3 o'clock in the morning. You know what it is to be 3 o'clock in the morning? With a conscience. And then when I left there, the other thing he told me, and somebody mentioned it to me today, was the Hound of Heaven. He read that out to me. You know about God being like a dog, always chasing you. You can hear him running behind you. And that is so true. That is so true, because what I remembered was when I was kicked out of school by the nuns because I had hit one of them. She hit me first. And I figured if she could give it, she could take it. But the priest told me how to make amends to the nun, right? But what happened was, here's how I know that God is always with us. When I remove the things that are blocking me from God, God's there. You know, when Abby went to Bill Wilson, when Bill was in Torrance Hospital, and Bill was so amazed by the time, when he went to see him at his home before he got to Torrance, Bill was amazed. He said, "Whatever it was with Abby, it had not been inside Abby, it had come from outside of Abby." That's what it looks like. It looks like suddenly we unblock and God comes in. We create an aperture by despair, a little crack in our armor, and God comes in. That's a beautiful thing. I mean, for me, the greatest thing in my life, and sitting down and doing all of that with that priest, was that he was non-judgmental. That he wasn't afraid to tell me how my actions had devastated and made my soul sick and separated me from God. That God had always been with me. When I was kicked out of school and the Mother Superior said to me, "Come and sit outside my door, we've called your mother." No, she said, "We've called your long-suffering mother." "You're expelled, and I want you to sit outside my door and memorize that sign above my door, and it might do something for your measly little life." The nuns were beautiful people. They were trying to teach me what you taught me. They were trying to teach me to be kind, to be gentle, to be loving, to be helpful. They live a life of dedicated service to God, for God's sake. To God and their fellows. And I am belittling them because I believe in nothing. So anyway, I sat outside and I thought, I'm going to memorize that in case she asked me, because I have a good memory. So I looked at this sign and it said, of courtesy it is much less than courage of heart or holiness, but in the walks to me it seems that the grace of God is in courtesy. And way back then I wanted nothing to do with the grace of God, and I wanted nothing to do with courtesy. But many, many years later, coming through these doors, a broken down alcoholic, a failure in every department of life, it was the grace of God that brought me here. And it was the great courtesy that you extended to me. It's only in these rooms do we embrace the sickest of the sick and say, come, we're just like you. It doesn't matter what you've done. When I came out that morning from that priest, and this is how symbolic it was for me, from I had ended up in the street, I always walked in the dark side of the street. I never ever walked in the sunshine because I hated myself. And when I came out in downtown Edmonton on that morning after doing that fifth step, I crossed over into the sunlight, literally. Big buildings downtown Edmonton, and there was this big sunny patch. And it's like it was the hand of God beckoning me over. I get goosebumps. It was like, I mean, I know I'm Irish and I see fairies, but I mean, that's what. You think I'm joking, man. It was like the hand of God beckoning me over. I am so very, very grateful. Carl Jung spoke about the shadow. And the shadow is something that everybody has inside of himself. And you either get to know the shadow, which is what we do. Because remember, for 4 years, Bill and Bob didn't have the big book. There was no big book. What they did have was Jung. And if you ever went to Dr. Bob's library, you'd see a lot of Jung. They both loved Jung. And I believe they were dealing with the shadow principle that Jung talks about, which can eventually lead us into perdition. And the other thing that happens with the shadow is it gets projected. I don't want to look at me, so I'm going to project all my wrongs onto you. And that was eventually what I found out, because I started it then. After a few months, I did the steps in the big book the way they were meant to be done. But that was how I had. That was how I had to do it. That was how I had to deal with it in the beginning, because I didn't have direction. And I had a lot of love in AA. I had unconditional love. I had the fact that the big book has the answers, but you got to read it. I will tell you today, I don't take people through the big book. I don't take my sponsees through the big book. I'm not doing it. I tell them, okay, for the first step, I want you to read Bill's story. I want you to read the doctor's opinion. I want you to write a summary about what you found in there and how much you agree and identify with it. And then I want you to bring that work to me. Because I have found in sitting down, it's like rote. The minute they leave me after going through this book, a lot of them, if I gave them a question, they wouldn't know what I was talking about. I want them to sit down and do it the way I did it. That's all I have. All I have to give is what was given to me. But none of my sponsors. I had a sponsor, Rini. She died with 53 years sobriety. Rini loved the book, but she loved the 12 and 12. Hey, Polly? She loved the 12 and 12. And Rini used to take me, because she said to me, look, you have no gone where you're... A situation came up in my life, and she said, let's go more in depth. The reason Bill Wilson wrote the 12 and 12 was he wanted to go more in depth. Because, you know, he wrote it a good few years afterwards, and he wrote it when he was coming out of depression. And, you know, I have suffered from depression too, and I've found that it's, for me, it's when I'm completely self-obsessed. Leave me alone, I want to think about me. Do not call me, I'm thinking about me. Okay, so these to me are the greatest steps. However, they are only the greatest steps if you have the foundation of 1, 2, and 3. Without 1, 2, and 3, I believe it would be like building a house on sand. You could do 4 and 5, but you don't have that strong, strong, strong support underneath. It's been my experience that the people who do not do the 4th and 5th step quickly are the ones who do get drunk quickly, because they are the ones who cannot bear to live in their head. And the very thing they should be doing is what they're not doing. For me, I still do. I will finish up with this little story that happened. You may have heard it before, but it just brought me right back, because it only happened about 4 years ago, and I had to go back and do a 4th step. I was working for a woman that God had put in my life to test my serenity. You know, I'm not telling my story, but I had been married and my husband had had a massive stroke, and I spent years at home looking after him, and it's the most spiritual form of loving I've ever had. And he died, but you see, there wasn't a lot of money left. So in my 60s, I had to go back to work. And so it was a good job, and I was getting paid well, and I liked it, and I didn't like her. And it was just her and I in the office. And she used to throw files at me. And, you know, my natural instinct. was to take up the file and wrap it around her stringy little neck. That was my natural instinct. Instead, AA said, AA kicked in. I said, you know, you really shouldn't do that. You're going to upset yourself. And then I'd call my sponsor. And she'd jack out me. I really need the money. So anyway, one morning I went in, and I couldn't have been in fit spiritual condition. Because when I walked in the door, this is four years ago, when I walked in the door, she threw a file at me. And I said to my God, God, I'll see you when I come out. And I closed the door, and it was just her and me. And I took her inventory from when she was birthed. And you know that horrendous anger? My kids used to say napalm. It was like napalm. And it gives you a power surge. You know, Michael? You know that anger? I mean, it's powerful. It eases God out and you in, and it's powerful. I mean, that rage, it scares people. I've had 4 husbands and they all have nervous conditions they never had. Have a good night's sleep. So anyway, I lost it, and then of course you come out of it and you think, oh my, and she's sitting cowering in her chair, you know, like this. And she said to me, I think you should go home, you're not feeling well.
because she's just experienced Jekyll and Hyde.
I said to her, you go home, I've got work to do.
Because now I want to get back to normal and call my sponsor, right? Immediately.
So she leaves. She scuttles a wheelie.
I'm thinking, you won't be throwing any more files, kid.
And when she left, I started to weep. Because I was so ashamed of myself. Oh my God, I'm 28 years sober. And I've done this. This is dreadful. And I kneel down and I pray and I ask God to forgive me for treating one of his kids like that and for easing him out, leaving him at the door, so to speak. And then I called my sponsor, Norma. It was Norma at the time. I told her what happened. And she said, I told you. You're always staying in relationships past the expiry date. She said, I want you to go in tomorrow and make amends and give a week's notice. And then you and I will have to do some work. So what we did is we got out of the book again. And we did the four columns. And what we discovered, you see, a step 10 wouldn't have been enough there, because that was so deep. I mean, I didn't even know that I still had that in me. I thought my rage was gone. I thought it was gone. And when we sat down and we did some work, we realized that lady had brought something up in me that had happened long ago, real or imagined. Something that happened to me as a child that made me feel so powerless, so helpless, so angry, so rageful and unable. She plucked it like there was a little scab on it, and she pulled off the scab, and I had just erupted. And so we did the work on it. I got to look at it, take it out, look at it, make amends to her, and pay attention to it. So you see, the work's never ending in this fourth and fifth. Never ending. So I'm so grateful to be here. I want to thank you all. I just love this girl's talk so bad. You know, I never used to like women. And I absolutely love women. And, you know, just finishing with an elevator story, because it just came to my mind. I was speaking in Hawaii. A long time ago. And the name of the conference was Inside Job. And I was in an elevator with all these other AAs. It was a Design for Living. A Design for Living was the name of the conference. And we were all in the elevator with the Design for Living on here. And this man got on the elevator and said, what is this? Is it an interior decorator conference? And I thought to myself, that is very appropriate. 4 and 5, interior decorators. Right? It's an inside job. Thank you.